The Guardian.
Welcome to Politics Weekly Extra. I'm Jonathan Friedland. Election Day in America was 2.5 weeks ago, 13 days since Joe Biden was declared the winner, and yet the sitting president, Donald Trump, still refuses to acknowledge reality. Instead, he's tweeting out a stream of lies and groundless claims about election fraud. That has some people worried about what should be happening right now, which is a smooth, orderly transition of power. Part of that should be national security briefings for the incoming president, along with daily updates on the coronavirus so that Joe Biden can start readying the federal response that in January he will be leading. He is getting on with stuff, setting up a COVID-19 task force and making a series of appointments, but it shouldn't be this way. Still, Trump's toddler antics are not the only cloud on Biden's horizon. The new president says he wants to unify the country after a toxic election, but even uniting his own party looks tricky, as the left and moderate factions do battle against each other. It's a familiar conundrum for parties on the left and centre-left all over the world. How progressive is too progressive? If you delight young, educated voters in the cities, will you alienate your traditional supporters, including blue-collar workers, in the towns? As this argument rages, there's no guarantee that the conflicting camps will fall in behind the new president. A soft truce held through the election campaign, but now the cracks are starting to show, not least because, although Biden won big, Democrats in the House lost seats, while Democrats in the Senate failed to make the gains they were hoping for. So, our question for this week, can Joe Biden and Kamala Harris unite the Democratic Party? And what happens if they can't? To discuss all of that, I'm joined by The Guardian's West Coast political reporter, Manvi Singh. Manvi, welcome to the pod. I think this is your first time, and it's very lovely to have you. You are based, I think, there in California, which went massively for Joe Biden. Now, a fortnight on, are people where you are still immersed in the moment of when the election was called, or is some of that adrenaline beginning to fade away?
Yeah, you know, actually, it's a bit overcast and chilly here, by California standards, at least in the Bay Area. And the jubilation has definitely cooled off right after the election results were announced. You know, there was dancing in the streets and pot banging as there was, you know, across the U.S. But now I think some of the sobering realities have really set in, where we're seeing the number of coronavirus cases in California climbing as they are in the rest of the U.S. We are struggling through an economic crisis. It's been a really rough year here in California, where we've had massive wildfires destroying homes, disrupting lives. So, you know, there is that sense of relief. Californians are thinking, you know, maybe our state doesn't have to necessarily be at war with the administration anymore pretty soon. But at the same time, there's still these like massive issues that we need to address.
And do you think the fact that Donald Trump has not conceded or even actually just accepted the results in any way, has that sort of taken some of the shine off the result and the victory for Joe Biden among his supporters there? You know, has it sort of dampened the mood?
Of course. You know, we saw this coming, but to see it actually happening is obviously still disappointing, and it still adds to that sense of like uncertainty. There have been a couple of like exit polls which aren't necessarily super reliable, but one of the funny ones that asked this where voters across the aisle really agreed what they really wanted was something to be settled. Like, they just wanted the election to be over, and they have yet to receive that kind of final feeling of feeling settled.
Yeah, that closure is something that's in very short supply, and you're just not going to get that from Donald Trump. He doesn't really do that, I don't think, that kind of healing moment of closure. But let's get into the battle that is on one side of the aisle, and that is among Democrats, progressive and moderate wings, who did sort of hold it together during the election. It does seem they are now beginning to find fault with each other. Just give us a sense of who's saying what on which side.
There's, of course, a gradient, but to sort of break it down, on one side, you've got the moderates or centrists, most of the party's leading figures, probably fall into this category, including Joe Biden and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. In a lot of ways, this side sort of wants a return to normalcy, or what they consider normalcy, after four very chaotic, norm-breaking years of Donald Trump as president. And then on the other side, you've got the progressives, you know, you've got Bernie Sanders.
Democratic socialism means that in a democratic, civilized society, the wealthiest people and the largest corporations must pay their fair share of taxes.
Also, this diverse coalition of like young, justice-minded politicians like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
Medicare for all would save the American people a very large amount of
money. And Ilhan Omar and, you know, many others. And also, you know, activists and grassroots organizers who want to see ambitious action. They want to see reforms. They want to see, you know, movement on climate change policy and an overhaul of the healthcare system and meaningful criminal justice reform. And they're thinking, well, you know, it's not normal and it's not going to go back to normal. Let's just make changes that benefit people.
And what about the relative weights of these two camps? And I absolutely accept that these are very broad brush generalizations we're making, but are they more or less equal in size on Capitol Hill and also in the country?
I would say on Capitol Hill, progressives are definitely a smaller group than the moderate kind of institutionalist candidates. But they are growing, and I think support for some of their policies have been growing in recent years. You know, there have been researchers at Yale and other universities tracking over the years what sorts of climate change policies people support. And, you know, what once might have been sort of impossible to conceive of, which is people, you know, Americans really getting behind progressive policies like Medicare for All, which is like a government healthcare policy that Bernie Sanders and other progressives have touted, or, you know, ambitious climate change policy. Like, those are things that more and more Americans are starting to get behind.
And how much is this actually an ideological argument, or is it, and this would be my sense partly just how this argument plays out on this side of the Atlantic, that in a way the so-called moderates don't disagree in principle with, you know, really strong policies on the climate crisis or on healthcare, it's all electoral. Their worry is that if you move too far left, you lose voters, particularly those on the center ground. And so it's not an ideological argument, it's almost a tactical one about electability and what wins. Is that the shape of the argument between the camps where you are, or do you imagine it is a principle disagreement between these two camps?
I think to a large part, you're right. This is really tactical. There was this really contentious call among House Democrats that has been widely reported on, including by The Guardian.
Congresswoman Abigail Spanberger, Democrat out of Virginia, we were told it was very heated on this call, very upset. And she said this reportedly, quote, "We lost races we shouldn't have lost. Defund the police almost cost me my race because of an attack ad. Don't say socialism ever again. We need to get back to basics."
But the gist of that call was basically like, you know, what's happening? Why did Democrats lose seats in the House? Why were our predictions wrong? And what went wrong? And there was a lot of finger pointing and blaming. And on the one side, you've got people arguing we move too far to the left to kind of lose people at the center. And it's a real challenge for candidates who are running as Democrats in more conservative regions. But on the other hand, okay, maybe this is politically difficult, but maybe we still want to support these policies because we believe they're important. Maybe this is about making the case to more Americans that this is why we stand for these policies instead of just, you know, being afraid of Republican attacks.
One of the big sort of lines that has been cited is this slogan, defund the police. And Democratic congressman, who's, I think he's the majority whip, Jim Clyburn of South Carolina, crucial player in this year's election story because it was his endorsement of Joe Biden that really swung South Carolina for Biden in the primaries back in February. But he has said that his fear is that this slogan, defund the police, really hurt the Democrats.
This foolishness about you've got to be this progressive or that progressive, that phrase, defund the police, cost Jimmy Harrison tremendously.
Maybe reduced their majority in the House and played a role in preventing them retaking the Senate. Just explain for us the origin of that phrase, why it did bubble up this summer, and why people like Jim Clyburn think it was so important in the election that's just gone.
Right. You know, defund the police, that's really a slogan and policy that's come out of the sort of grassroots activists who have been fighting against police brutality for years. And, you know, this has really come out from people who have been directly affected by police violence against Black people and against Brown people. And it kind of came into or became a bit of a talking point this year amid nationwide protests against police brutality after the police killing of George Floyd and other prominent cases that were caught on video that were widely reported post-election and during the primaries. This was definitely a talking point, is like this is going to scare away moderates, or this is going to, if we stick by this policy, which is so left or so revolutionary, we're not going to win the sort of centrist Republican swing voters or independents that Democrats sort of wanted to get. I think it's probably too early in terms of just statistics and polling as to say whether that's actually true. My sense is it's impossible to like boil it all down to one slogan or one sort of policy, right?
In this argument of left and versus center left or moderate, it's been very clear where Joe Biden fits in. People know him for decades. They know his backstory and his politics. And indeed, it meant when people were throwing around the term radical socialist, it just never really stuck to Joe Biden because they'd known him as this, you know, Washington pragmatist for decades. What about, though, Kamala Harris and her place on the ticket? She's much less of a known quantity than Joe Biden. She's been on Capitol Hill, you know, a fraction of the time he was there. Where does she fit in that fault line between, you know, AOC at one end and Joe Biden at the other? Where would you slot Kamala Harris?
I think ideologically, Kamala Harris is probably a little bit to the left of Joe Biden, but she's really, you know, a centrist as well. And that's sort of why it made so much sense, among other reasons, that Joe Biden picked her as his vice presidential running mate. But Harris is an interesting case because as a senator, she has voted with progressives. But on the other hand, she has sort of a complicated history as a prosecutor, as a top cop.
Right.
You know, speaking of the Black Lives Matter movement, she was a real disappointment for a lot of people who wanted to see her prosecute, you know, cops more strongly for violence against citizens. They were kind of skeptical of Kamala Harris, and I think continue to be so.
Sure. And the reason partly people focused on her so much, it was an early sign of what Joe Biden planned to do in terms of unifying the disparate wings of his party. He seemed to have succeeded with that choice. Most people found that was a choice, Kamala Harris, that they could live with. What about some of the other appointments he's made in this sort of non-transition transition, this kind of transition in exile that he's having to conduct? He has announced a few appointments. What do people read into that in terms of which way he's tilting? You know, which of these different camps within the Democratic Party he is leaning to and favoring, perhaps?
Right. So, you know, I think it's been kind of a rocky road, and it's still early days as Biden plans his transition. But post-Democratic primaries, when Bernie Sanders lost to Joe Biden, Democrats created this Biden-Sanders Unity Task Force. And that was really meant to bring together the factions, unite everyone against Donald Trump. And now, you know, people are looking at Biden's transition and his cabinet appointments as really an opportunity to see whether he's going to continue that sort of unity task force in his administration. Progressives have this like wish list where they really want to see Bernie Sanders appointed as labor secretary. They want to see Elizabeth Warren appointed treasury secretary. And so far, it's in a mixed bag. So Biden appointed Ron Klain as his chief of staff.
Well, these two go back more than 30 years when the president-elect was a senator in Delaware.
Which progressives celebrated. You know, Klain had this like unusual distinction of being pretty well liked and respected by Democrats across the political spectrum. But then he appointed Cedric Richmond, a congressman of Louisiana, as senior advisor.
He'll also serve as a go-between for climate activists in the oil industry while Biden works to cut pollution.
And progressive groups, including the Sunrise Movement, which is this like progressive environmental advocacy group, called it a betrayal because Richmond has taken in a lot of fossil fuel donations. So ups and downs.
Yeah, I mean, that is the perils of those appointments. It's interesting to hear what you say about Ron Klein, because Ron Klein is one of those people who each faction claim as one of their own. Just indulge me on this one. I'm interested when you mentioning Elizabeth Warren. The downside, I would guess, I suppose, for Joe Biden about an appointment like that is that then creates a vacancy in the Senate. The Democratic hold there is so precarious, even if they win those two Georgia seats, it will only be 50-50. There will be memories of the special election in Massachusetts, which saw Scott Brown elected, a Republican. I just wonder if that will inhibit the appointments Biden might otherwise make, because he just won't want to create vacancies in the Senate and just risk the possibility that an open seat somehow goes to the Republicans.
That's definitely one of the reasons Biden might not appoint Warren to his cabinet, because she's a senator, it's a really powerful voice in the Senate from a state that has a Republican governor, albeit a moderate Republican governor. And yeah, definitely a lot of these appointments are going to be complicated by considerations about whether politicians would be more usefully placed in the Senate or in Congress.
Last thought on this before we ask you our what else question. The last thought on this is Joe Biden won. He won well. He could not have been a more traditional figure, literally an old white man. Does that tilt the argument that he's going to play out in the party for the next 4 years, almost where they say, look, the only way we can ever win in this quite conservative country is with someone like Joe Biden? Or, on the contrary, does a win mean that actually with the Democrats in power, all kinds of things will become possible and actually the left might have their day in the sun? How do you see these next 4 years playing out?
You know, so that's sort of interesting. Yes, Joe Biden, old white dude, very traditional, candidate. But Kamala Harris, who he chose as his running mate, he chose her really, and he said this as a recognition that Democrats need to fold in more diversity. She's a historic pick. And during both Biden and Harris's sort of victory speeches, they really acknowledged the role that Black voters, especially Black women, played in helping deliver that victory to Democrats, and sort of promised to keep that in mind and acknowledge that and honor that in their administration. Obviously, we'll have to see how that goes. But I think, you know, when we talk about this division and about tactics of how to build support for Democrats, you know, one of the major arguments of progressives, especially young people of color who are either activists or elected officials, is the Democratic Party really needs to acknowledge the work of Black and brown people who have been building support, who've been galvanizing their communities, who've been galvanizing the electorate to vote for Democrats. They're saying, well, you can't just come here every 2 to 4 years asking for votes. You need to support us. You need to support local candidates, and you need to bring us into the higher echelons of power as well.
Now, we did promise our what else question. We always try to do that here on the podcast. So, Manvi, Trump has fired his director of U.S. cybersecurity, Chris Krebs.
Krebs has publicly defended the integrity of the November election. Just last week, his former agency signed on to a statement contradicting the president's baseless claims about election interference, writing, "There is no evidence that any voting system deleted or lost votes, changed votes, or was in any way compromised."
What do you make of this firing?
A lot of people expected this firing to happen. But at the same time, I think, you know, when you look at Trump's continued doubling down on these baseless claims of voter fraud and his refusal to accept the election results, on the one hand, practically that's unlikely to change anything, right? Like, the bottom line is he's lost by such a margin that the results of the election aren't going to change. He is the loser. But I think where these claims are landing is in the ears of like loyal supporters. And that's where it's concerning, because it's really deepening divisions and encouraging the sorts of people who crowded outside vote counting centers and threatened elections officials. It's encouraging groups like the Proud Boys, who are white supremacist militant hate group who got into violent altercations with counter protesters in DC this weekend. And so these actions are kind of sowing confusion and division. And that, I think, is sort of the worrying part.
Absolutely. I think most people are probably ignoring it, but the people he needs to hear it are hearing it. And that could be the potential audience for, who knows, his next media venture or even for another campaign. Manvi Singh, this has been great fun. Thanks so much for talking to us about all of this stuff. And thanks for coming on the podcast.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
And now that the rolling news cycle of this election is over, I want to hear from you. Is there a question you want answered on this podcast that you're not seeing answered anywhere else? If so, please email. The address is podcasts@theguardian, all one word, theguardian.com. Or you can tweet me. My handle is @Friedland, FREEDLAND. But that is that for this week. Do make sure you've caught up with Wednesday's episode of Politics Weekly, where The Guardian's deputy political editor, Jessica Elgott, brings us all the latest on the Labour Party's conundrum over what to do about its former leader, Jeremy Corbyn. Can the current leader, Keir Starmer, unify those on the left and the centre of the party? Now, where have we heard that before? The producer is Danielle Stevens. I'm Jonathan Friedland. Please do take care of yourself. And thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.